Thank you to the Property Council for asking me to speak at this Property Leaders Summit. I want to address an important issue for the property industry, the rising rate of housing loan arrears in Australia. Why is it that an increasing share of household borrowers are finding it difficult to make their mortgage repayments, are behind in their repayment schedule? Mortgage arrears can be associated with significant trauma for households. They also point to a rising risk to the financial system, as home loans account for 40% of banks' assets. If the value of the property backing the loan exceeds the value of the loan, then arrears won't have a big impact on banks' profits or their capital. But with falling housing prices, the potential for banks to experience losses increases. So on several fronts, this is an important issue. There are many reasons why households can fall into arrears, almost all of which involve some fall of income or a rise in expenses, or both. Some household borrowers experience personal misfortune, such as ill health or a relationship breakdown, that are unrelated to economic conditions or the quality of the loan. And even in good times, some people become unemployed, so there will always be some borrowers who are in arrears. However, it is weak economic conditions that drive cyclical upswings in arrears. In particular, borrowers can struggle to make their repayments if their income falls. Weak conditions in housing markets can also make it more difficult for borrowers to get out of arrears by selling their property. Conversely, large increases in interest rates, say to slow an overheated economy, can also lead to rising arrears. Banks' lending standards also play a role in arrears, and it is important to note that economic conditions and lending standards can interact in driving arrears. Poorer quality loans might continue to perform well in good conditions, but then fall into arrears with an economic downturn. In contrast, good quality loans will be more resilient even in an economic downturn. Because of the interaction of the various drivers of arrears, it's hard to point to a single cause for the increase in arrears. Today, I want to discuss the ways in which economic conditions and lending standards have been interacting to push arrears higher. But first, it is worth pausing to compare some benchmarks for the level of arrears. The share of borrowers of housing loans in arrears is now back around the level reached in 2010, and the highest it has been for many years before that. But the rate of arrears is still well below where it got to in the early 1990s recession. While the increase in arrears and the level is notable, the rate of arrears in Australia is still relatively low internationally and in an absolute sense. The available data indicate that arrears are lower in Australia than in many other advanced economies. Indeed, another way of looking at the arrears rate is to note that over 99% of housing loans are on or ahead of schedule. Making loans involves risks, and banks are used to managing this risk. If the arrears rate was persistently low, that would indicate that banks were being excessively cautious in their lending. In that world, it would mean that some borrowers who would almost certainly be able to repay their loan would not be able to get credit. So what drives arrears? Income is a major determinant of whether borrowers are able to meet their loan repayments. Strong employment growth for a number of years now has seen the unemployment rate decline. On the surface, this makes it surprising that the rate of arrears has been rising. But the relationship between unemployment, income, and arrears isn't straightforward. One factor at play is that while the unemployment rate has declined nationally, that hasn't been the case everywhere. What we can see across Australia is that there is a clear pattern of more loans going into arrears in locations where the unemployment rate is higher. Notably, the unemployment rate has increased and income has declined in Western Australia and parts of Queensland, that were affected by the downturn in mining activity. These areas have seen the largest increases in housing loan arrears. In Western Australia, the arrears rate is double what it is in the rest of the country. But even the flow of loans into arrears in these locations is more than would be suggested by the unemployment rate alone. So there are more factors at play. Indeed, rising unemployment in some areas can't be the whole story. As I said, the national unemployment rate has declined. So when it comes to arrears, falling unemployment in some locations hasn't compensated for rising unemployment in others. One explanation is that it can matter who becomes unemployed and who gets a job. People aged in their 30s and 40s, particularly if they have good employment prospects, are more likely to have a mortgage. So if more of them become unemployed, this will lead to a rise in arrears rates. Conversely, if it is older or younger people who get jobs, or those who don't have a mortgage, or second income earners in households that are already comfortably making their mortgage repayments, then this gain in employment won't be reflected in a decline in arrears rates. The length of unemployment can also matter for arrears. Around two-thirds of borrowers have accumulated prepayment buffers on their mortgages, and some have other savings outside their mortgage. Households with financial buffers can withstand some period of unemployment, but if it extends for too long and depletes their savings, they risk falling into arrears. There are several other reasons why focusing on unemployment alone doesn't tell the full story. It isn't that all borrowers either receive income or don't. Often borrowers may lose some portion of their income, say because of reduced hours of work, a period of not receiving a bonus, or because tenants move out of their rental property. When they don't have a large income or savings buffer, even small income falls can lead to an increase in arrears. Indeed, in Western Australia, where arrears have picked up most, there has been a significant increase in high level of rental property vacancies. And this reduces the income of landlords. The rate of income growth can play a role too. When nominal income is rising strongly over time, mortgage payments take up a declining share of households' available income. As the mortgage ages and their income rises, borrowers are better placed to withstand a fall in their income or a rise in expenses. Over the past 5 years, nominal income growth has been around half its longer run average. So rising income hasn't been able to compensate for other factors that might push borrowers into arrears. Another recent feature of arrears is that, on average, mortgages are staying in arrears for longer. There are several possible explanations for this. Mortgages can leave arrears because the lender takes possession of the property and sells it. However, the number of repossessed properties from mortgages is very small, and if anything, has risen slightly, so this can't explain longer loan arrears. Alternatively, borrowers can leave arrears by selling their property and repaying the loan. If a strong housing market, it is easy for the borrower struggling to make repayments or who's already in arrears to sell their property. In this strong housing market, it doesn't take long to sell a property at an attractive price. The borrower is also likely to have seen several years of strong price growth, increasing their equity. So if they sell, they are better placed to pay off their mortgage and still have some savings. But nationally, housing prices have fallen 8% from their peak, auction clearance rates have declined, as have auction volumes, and the time taken to sell properties has increased. In this environment, borrowers who fall into arrears find it harder to sell their property and repay their loan. Indeed, in this graph, we can see across the country, there is a strong relationship between recent housing price growth and the rate at which borrowers are able to leave arrears. In those locations where housing price growth has been weaker, a smaller share of borrowers transition out of arrears. The weaker housing market has also seen housing credit growth slow. Because loans tend to take some time to go into arrears, this has the effect of reducing the number of new loans that are easily making payments. And so this increases the overall arrears rate. But our estimates suggest that slower credit growth has contributed for less than 1/10 of the increase in the arrears rate since 2016. Another driver of arrears can be changes in interest rates. In the period before the GFC, arrears rates were rising despite economic conditions being strong. In part, this was because of large increases in mortgage interest rates. However, in recent years, interest rates on outstanding mortgages have actually been declining, so this hasn't contributed to a generalised increase in arrears. Lending standards are also an important driver of arrears. Weaker lending standards mean that borrowers can get larger loans and more borrowers can get loans with potentially riskier characteristics, such as interest-only periods. For a borrower, the larger their required loan repayments relative to their available income, the slower they will be able to build up financial buffers, and so they will be more likely to fall into arrears if they have an income shock or their expenses rise. With weaker lending standards, more borrowers will be able to borrow who are likely to experience difficulty repaying their loan, say because they have unstable income. For these reasons, weaker lending standards can lead to higher rates of arrears. In Australia, there has been a significant tightening of housing lending standards by the regulators and of banks and other lenders, starting in earnest from around 2014. Regulators took these actions among concerns that strong housing market conditions and strong competition by lenders had seen lending standards erode. The actions taken by APRA include that banks apply more stringent interest rate buffers to maximum loan calculations, apply more scrutiny to borrowers' income and expenses, and reduce the share of lending at high loan-to-valuation ratios. Complementing this, ASIC increased their focus on lenders' compliance with responsible lending obligations, particularly in the area of interest-only lending. These actions were designed to ensure that lenders only extended as much debt as borrowers were capable of repaying. Tighter lending standards should lead to lower arrears, but this can take some time to show up. Typically, borrowers' financial pressures build over time, and so average arrears rates increase with time since the loan was originated, that is, loan seasoning. For example, a three-year-old housing loan is four times more likely to go into arrears than a one-year-old loan. Another challenge of assessing the impact of lending standards on arrears is that different cohorts of loans experience common macroeconomic shocks at different times in their seasoning. If there was a sharp increase in unemployment in a given year, the cohort of loans originated 1 year earlier will have only 12 months of seasoning, whereas those loans originated 3 years earlier will have 36 months of seasoning. This suggests that more recent loans would likely have a larger increase in arrears in response to a rise in unemployment. Using the Reserve Bank securitisation data set, we find evidence consistent with more recent cohorts of home loans having lower arrears rates than earlier cohorts. Specifically, in this graph, we can see that those loans originated in the past few years have lower arrears rates by up to 0.25 percentage point than those loans originated prior to 2014. The lower arrears rates for more recent loans suggest that tighter lending standards have been beneficial for arrears rates. However, in other ways, measures taken to improve lending standards may actually increase arrears rates in the near term. One measure addressed the large and increasing share of loans that were interest-only, meaning that the borrower was not required to make regular principal repayments, and so the loan size did not necessarily decline over time. In 2017, APRA imposed a 30% benchmark for the maximum share of a borrower's loans that could be interest-only. The benchmark has since been removed, but recognising the greater risk of interest-only lending, banks continue to charge higher interest rates for interest-only loans and more carefully scrutinise their suitability for borrowers. As a result, some borrowers who may have anticipated being able to roll over an interest-only period are finding they cannot. Some are then facing temporary difficulty making the higher principal and interest repayments at the end of the interest-only period. However, most borrowers in this position are able to get their loan repayments back on track within a year. Tighter lending standards may have made it more difficult for some borrowers to refinance their loan. In general, a borrower who, say, experienced a decline in income may be able to reduce their repayments by refinancing with a loan that is at a lower interest rate or has a longer term and so lower repayments. But borrowers who are financially stretched are more likely to be constrained by tighter borrowing conditions. If they can't refinance and struggle to make their existing repayments, they are more likely to fall into arrears. There have also been some reports of banks displaying greater forbearance on their housing loans, that is, allowing loans to stay in arrears for a longer period. Supposedly, this is in response to a recognition of and attention on some past poor lending practices. However, it seems unlikely that this could explain a significant part of the increase in aggregate arrears. In an environment of falling housing prices, allowing a borrower to remain in arrears for longer would increase the potential loss for that borrower, and so the loss that the lender is also exposed to. This wouldn't seem to be operating in the best interests of the borrower, and nor for that matter, even for the lender. Summing up, housing arrears have been rising, but by no means to a level that poses a risk to financial stability. Several factors have been interacting to affect the increase in arrears rates. Economic conditions are undoubtedly part of the story. Weak income growth, house price falls, and rising unemployment in some areas have all likely contributed. But they have not acted alone. Interacting with earlier tightening in lending standards, the earlier weak lending standards, and the more recent tightening in lending standards. To the extent that we can point to the drivers of the rise in arrears, we can see that economic outlook remains quite reasonable and household growth is expected to increase. The influence of at least some other drivers, however, may not reverse course sharply in the near future. And so it is quite possible that the arrears rate could continue to edge up higher in the near term. But with overall strong lending standards, so long as unemployment remains low, arrears rates should not rise to a level that poses a risk to the financial system or causes great harm to households. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. So we now have some roving microphones. So if you wanted to ask a question, feel free to. Or you can also send your questions through our website, which is up on the screen with the details there. So I might just kick off and talk about a little bit about, you talked about APRA's tightening of lending standards and what happened back in December 2014. APRA started to ease those back now. We're starting to see that come through. But if you were to cast your mind back, given how quickly that's really, I guess, impacted house prices and the knock-on consequence that's had to arrears as well, do you think we moved too quickly and tightened those lending standards too quickly? You know, what are your reflections now with the benefit of hindsight?
Well, I think the first thing to note is we do think that the tightening in housing lending standards had some impact on the property market. But by and large, most of the decline in the housing market has come through from weaker demand. There are a few factors driving the weaker demand. One of which was just that there'd been such a big increase in property prices that the level of prices became unaffordable for a large number of borrowers. But there had also been a very big increase in supply. The property sector had taken some time to respond to the increase in population growth and the increase in demand that had occurred. We'd also seen a reduction in demand coming from foreign investors. There'd been a significant reduction coming from China. So it's interesting if we look at sort of house prices versus for detached houses versus the prices for apartments. If it was going to be the lending standards that had driven this, those lending standards have probably affected investors more so than owner-occupiers because of the impact on interest-only loans and so forth, and the benchmark on investor credit growth. So investors tend to buy more apartments, so if it was these lending standards driving things, we would have expected to have seen declines in apartment prices more so than detached house prices. But ultimately, in order to sort of have a good financial system, we do need to have appropriately tight lending standards. So conditions had got to the point where it was necessary to have a tightening in lending standards, and that needed to happen at some stage. The sooner you do it, you end up having a better quality lending book, and so the financial system is more stable. So from our perspective, it was appropriate for APRA and ASIC to make those tightening decisions when they did.
And if you're looking forward to where we are right now with APRA having easing some of that back, but obviously the bank's now about to introduce some new, the new borrowing capacity rules as well. If you're looking forward and looking at some of the risks around those arrears and negative equity in homes, how much, are you concerned about house prices falling further and what that would then have to do in terms of impacts on negative equity, arrears, and the view on stability? You know, what's the magic number that house prices have to fall before you start to get more concerned?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think one thing to just start off in making comment about falling housing prices is that for many decades we had exceptionally strong house price growth, and I think a lot of people became conditioned by that. Now, there are reasons that house prices increased so strongly for a few decades, and that was the decline in interest rates and financial sector reform. And so that, you know, these were sort of one-off effects that stretched over a long period of time, but they were still one-off effects. So if looking forward, we wouldn't expect to see the average house price growth of 10% or more, which we had seen for many years. So if we're going to have lower average house price growth, we're going to experience periods of declining house prices more frequently, just because if you have a cycle around a lower mean. So that would indicate that, you know, the borrowers and lenders have to be making appropriate decisions, conditioning for the fact that you are more frequently going to have declines in prices. So far we've seen a decline nationally of a bit less than 10%. In Sydney and Melbourne it's been a bit more. And that has certainly contributed to some borrowers falling into negative equity, so, you know, where the value of their loan exceeds that of the property. And that is a bit of an issue for those borrowers and for the lenders exposed to them. But at the moment, we've estimated in our most recent financial stability review that only accounts for probably about 3% of banks' housing lending. But if you had another 10%, just because of the nature of where loan-to-valuation ratios sit, you would get a bigger increase than what we've seen to date. So it does accelerate the share of households that are in housing loan arrears. But 3% is still a pretty low number that won't cause significant problems for the financial sector and so their ability to lend.
That's great. So we spent a bit of time, I think, this morning talking about the housing sector and you've touched on it as well. It's obviously such an important part of the economy and also just a confidence in the market. But I might switch now to just the commercial real estate sector, because a lot of our delegates in the room are also very, very, you know, focused on the commercial sector. From the RBA's perspective, and I know you touched on this in your financial stability report, can you kind of just talk through some of the things that you look at when you look at the commercial real estate sector and how that, you know, the debt and financing in that sector impacts how you view the financial stability and some of the things that you look at as metrics in that commercial real estate space?
Sure. Okay. So we obviously look at the style of lending, the quality of lending, what lenders are involved in lending to the property sector. There are significant differences between when we look at the commercial property that is the construction of residential property, and that has quite different dynamics to the other parts of the commercial property sector. One of the things that we have seen is that there's been a large decline in rental yields on commercial property. And that seems to be essentially being driven by global factors in the decline in interest rates globally on all sorts of assets. And so whilst we think of the yields on commercial property in Australia as being quite low, in a global context, they're still relatively attractive, particularly given the very good economic conditions and the strong outlook with relatively strong population growth. And so we will tend to look at the amount of construction because there can tend to be sort of boom-bust cycles in commercial property. Historically, commercial property has tended to be one of the more significant problems for banks, you know, if we look back to the early 1990s in Australia. But currently, commercial property accounts for actually a relatively small share of banks' lending, and so doesn't seem to be a risk to them. It's been interesting seeing that a number of non-banks coming into the commercial property sector, and they're sort of harder for us to track because there's less information available about them, there's less reporting, but to the extent that these are sort of equity investments in it to an extent, they probably pose less of a risk for the financial sector because the money's not actually interacting with the banking system. So from our perspective, they're probably less risky. The risks that we can see when we have lenders outside our financial system, whether it's non-banks or international banks lending, is the potential that they drive the cycle further. And so you get more money flowing in, and that then influences prices. And so then that can influence the quality of the loans for our domestic banks. So we still do need to pay attention to what is coming from the rest of the world as well.
And just touching then, I think, on the non-bank sector, you were just saying, you know, that there's a lot of new entrants in the market. And in some ways, you could say that's a great thing because we're getting more competition into the market, and that's diversifying our funding sources. But what are some of the risks you see, and how is, you know, RBA and I think APRA working together to actually understand that market more and actually then be able to, I guess, quantify what those risks are, you know, and then develop appropriate kind of responses to that?
That's been a fairly important development in the housing lending space, coming back to that side, where APRA has gained new powers now for being able to collect more information from non-bank lenders. Because the first thing to do to know whether there is a risk to the financial system is to be able to measure it. And if we don't know how much lending is going on and by whom, we can't really assess that. Now, to the extent that sort of this lending ends up coming, say, from mortgage-backed securities, and if those mortgage-backed securities are being held by real money investors, then that is sort of diversifying the risk. And so I think that's actually a good thing. So to the extent that you can almost describe non-bank lenders in the current environment where we've had a tightening in lending standards by the banks, and potentially in some areas excessive caution, the existence of non-bank lenders actually acts as sort of a spare wheel for the financial system to ensure that lending is still going out. So it can be quite beneficial as well.
Well, fantastic. I think that brings us up to time. So if everyone can just join me in thanking Jonathan for being so generous with his time today.